Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Most people agree that elections in the United States have become really ugly in recent years. Here's one example. One candidate told the media that his opponent was a hermaphrodite that had neither the force and firmness of a man nor the gentleness and sensibility of a woman. The frontrunner's hatchet men counterattacked. They call his opponent a nasty lowlife who was vile offspring, a bloodthirsty warmonger who wanted to trigger war with America's enemies, leading to a national orgy of rape and incest. The slurs kept piling up. The frontrunner was called a criminal and a fascist. His opponent was called an atheist, cowardly weakling. Well, these descriptions, one might think, could have been fired back and forth between the camps of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton in 2016. But these were actually insults traded between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, two lifelong friends who architected the Declaration of Independence. This was in 1796. Jefferson's camp described Adams as having a hideous hermaphroditical character. Adams' men called Vice President Jefferson a mean-spirited, low-lived fellow, the son of a half-breed Indian squaw, sired by a Virginia mulatto father. So definitely not very sensitive on racial politics at the time. Well, the point being here is that American electoral politics have always been mean and cutthroat. But where does this come from? To look at this history of elections in America, I'm talking with David Severa. He's the host of the podcast, Early and Often, The History of Elections in America. We look at the origin of American electoral politics, going back to the Virginia Company and the colonies, where in the New World, there was much higher participation in elections because a far higher percentage of the population owned land compared to England or Europe. Then we discuss how the evolution of media in the United States creates political parties and political press from the mid-1700s, how there's a new rise in corruption with machine politics in the 1800s, and what history can tell us about the nastiness of elections today. David actually strikes a really optimistic tone and makes the point that elections in many ways were far worse in history than they are now, and nations have a much higher resilience than we give them credit for. So anyway, I really learned a lot about American electoral politics, and I hope you do too in this discussion with David Severa. David, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What you're focusing on, elections in the U.S., I think it's probably as sexy as it's ever been in many years. I've had guests on the show who've talked about the Electoral College. I've had other guests who've talked about the 17th Amendment, which allows voters to directly elect U.S. senators. And 2 or 3 years ago, really before 2016, nobody would have cared about this except for the most hardcore civics nerds you could find. But now it seems like it's a big deal. So what inspired you to devote a podcast to this topic? Was it recent issues in modern-day American politics, or was it something else?
No, it's more that I'm a civics nerd, I guess, that I've been thinking about politics for a very long time. I think the actual reason is that I'm not really a history nerd so much as a social science nerd. So my interest in history is more in figuring out what the patterns are, what the recurring events are, you know, what sort of person runs for president, how do the parties change over time predictably, that sort of thing. And so focusing in on elections was a very good way to bring out patterns, because elections are a regular thing. It's not so muddled. It's not so confusing. So, yeah, just looking at bringing out patterns, bringing out just the recurring events in history so you can make sense of today. It's definitely not a current events podcast. So,
yeah, I think for what I can see in your historical chronology, you haven't yet gotten to the formation of the United States. It's still in the colonies. Right. But I wonder, from what you've seen so far and what you've researched, when elections first begin in the colonies, in the New World, let us say, just as a big overview, can you see anything that is unique about elections in the New World compared to the Old World? Or is this something that takes a long time to develop?
I mean, I think it's both. Probably the biggest difference between the New World and the Old World is that there were elections in America at all. That was pretty uncommon by European standards that England had elections, but that was about it. Like, you know, there were elections here and there, but it was pretty monarchical or autocratic, however you want to put it. And the biggest difference between America and England was that so many more people had the vote. In England, it was like, you know, 2% of people, something like that, out of, you know, a few hundred thousand people out of a population of 5 million, something like that. Whereas in America, especially in New England, it was over 50% of people who had the vote, at least, men, I mean, 50% of men, even up to 70% in some cases. And I think the main reason for that is that Americans had so much more land. They were independent. They were economically independent. They weren't dependent on some big landlord who could tell them what to do, like in feudal Europe. They were pretty free. And so that was reflected in their political system. So in that sense, America was different. It's less different now because every other country has a big middle class and economic independence and that sort of thing. But that did mark it off mark America off as unique in the beginning.
With the earliest elections in the United States, with the founding of colonies like Jamestown and others, Chesapeake Bay, could you describe these elections? I mean, this sounds like something that is essentially a city council meeting. Was it like that, or was it something different? How did these earliest elections work?
I wouldn't call it a city council meeting exactly. It's kind of hard to come up with an analogy. The closest thing I would say is to a state election today, where you've got some independence, but not really that much independence, because you've got this overlord that's sort of watching everything you do and can cancel some of your legislation. I would say that they were semi-independent. They were concerned with issues like trade and things like that that a city council wouldn't be concerned with. But they also weren't making their own constitutions. They weren't really making their own big policy decisions. They were very constrained in that way. And as far as how elections went back then, it was a pretty different process, I'd say. For one thing, back then, for most of the colonies, except in New England, elections weren't held at a regular time. They were held whenever the governor wanted them to be held. It's kind of like in a parliamentary democracy today, not like in America. So for instance, in the Chesapeake, when the governors would call for an election, they would send word out to the sheriffs of each county, since it was a very county-based system. There were no real towns because Virginia was so rural. It was big plantations that were super spread out, super, super spread out. And the biggest town, Jamestown, only had like 1,000 people in it, you know, out of a much larger population. So the sheriffs would then get word of the election, when it was to be held, and so on. And they would, for a while, literally go door to door, knocking on people's doors, letting them know when the election was. But that proved to be kind of a terrible way of doing it, because people would be out, people would miss the message. And so there were complaints that, oh, I didn't know the election was going to be held, so how could I vote? So instead, what they did was they had the governor tell the sheriffs that when the elections were going to be held. Then the sheriffs told the ministers in each colony, in each county, when the election was going to be held, so that the minister could then announce it in church several weeks before the election, and then people would know, because that's the only time people would actually be in the same place in such a big county as in Virginia. Yeah, so there was no formal method of nominating candidates. You just kind of let people know that you were running, and that was it. So there was no real rules or anything. It was just however the sheriff wanted to do it. It would probably be at the local county courthouse or something like that. People would show up. There were no ballots. You would just kind of announced by a show of hands or by saying out loud who you were voting for. So there's no privacy, nothing like that. So it was a very different sort of system than we have today.
How would you run for an office? Were there anything like formal debates? I'm imagining that there wasn't enough infrastructure to print any sort of campaign literature or pamphlets. So how do you run a campaign back in the early, mid-1600s when there's so little population in the colonies?
You usually wouldn't, for the most part. If you did run a campaign, it would be very sort of informal. You would just kind of let people know you were running. You would go out and meet some people, talk to people. There were certainly no debates or anything like that, or campaign literature or anything like that, not until the mid-1700s, I'd say. what you might do is you might bribe the voters with food and alcohol. That was a big way of doing it. It was big enough that they had to make it illegal after a while. A lot of times, really, there wasn't even a campaign. It was just you kind of let people know you were running and see how and if you even had any competition, then you might see how things fell out. But it was really not very formal at all.
One of your episodes is entitled "The Pig Who Invented Bicameralism." Could you tell me about that?
Yes, sure. So back in the early days, back in the early 1600s, mid-1600s, the legislatures of each colonial assembly hadn't yet become bicameral. There was still one body of people voting at once. So these assemblies would usually be divided with two groups. For instance, you would have one group of voters, one group of delegates who was elected by the voters, and another group which was appointed. So you'd have these two different groups within the same assembly, and they each kind of clashed with each other. And that was the case in Massachusetts. But in Massachusetts, both the delegates were elected and the upper people were elected as well. So it was a little bit different than in the other colonies, but basically the same thing. You had these two groups within the assembly clashing. Now, in Massachusetts, what ultimately prompted this unicameral assembly to split up and become bicameral was a very minor lawsuit over a lost pig. So in Boston, in the 1630s, mid-1630s, about just a few years after it had been founded, there was a stray pig wandering around Boston. Nobody claimed it. So eventually a rich guy, I think his name was Richard Keene, he was a rich moneylender, he took the pig himself and he kind of stored it in his yard, whatever, fed it, kept it for a while to make sure that no one would claim it, and then when no one did claim it, he killed it. But right after he killed it, some poor woman said that, oh no, that had been her pig all along, and he had slaughtered it unlawfully, basically. He had stolen her pig. So she sued him for the loss of the pig, and he won the lawsuit, since there was really no evidence on her end. But he was very unpopular in the colony. She was very popular. He was a hated moneylender. She was just some nice poor lady. So then he sued her for defamation for saying, I didn't steal. He said, I didn't steal the pig. How dare you say this? And this court case went before the legislature, since the legislature at the time also took care of normal court cases sometimes, cases like that. So this split the two groups within the assembly down the middle. The delegates who all supported this poor popular woman, while the magistrates, who were still elected, but they were more elite, they were like senators compared to the House of Representatives, they all supported the rich guy. And this led to years and years of acrimony between them, like over all sorts of little different procedures and stuff. The delegates, the larger, more populist group, they made up a majority of the assembly, but they were blocked by the magistrates from getting their way. So it was a whole thing, and it played out for years, and eventually they had to split into two groups just to keep from fighting each other so much. So the pig who invented bicameralism, as I like to call it.
I love that these huge institutions that we have, state legislatures, the construction of our national democracy, go back to a pig. There are these very small, very regular things that make how we are today. So there you go.
Yes. I mean, and in Virginia, the reason they have a legislature at all was just because they needed to incentivize tobacco farmers to risk a very high chance of death. So, I mean, that's the legislature in Virginia today still traces its legacy back to that in like 1620. Like, oh God, how do we incentivize these farmers to come from England that'll probably die? You know, we'll give them an assembly. That way we don't have to pay them anything extra to get them to come.
Relabor. That's what we're all about. So,
yep.
Well, something that you focused on, and I think this is really useful for American history, particularly in the 17th century, is not to imagine New England colonies or Virginia colonies happening in isolation, as if people come to the New World and they have absolutely no contact with the Old World. That's not true. You tie in what's happening with American elections to what's happening with the rest of the world. And one is the massive growth of slavery, the growth of slave trade from Africa to the Caribbean on sugar plantations in the 1600s. So how does this huge growth of slavery in the New World affect American elections at this time?
Sure. Well, I'm not sure that it has a direct effect on American elections immediately. What it does is it creates a new culture within America itself over time. So the English had colonized the Caribbean just a little after Jamestown, right around the same time they were colonizing New England. And as you say, it was sugar plantations that were the big draw. Now, sugar plantations are just a horrible, brutal thing. It was just awful to, you know, even with all the money you could make growing sugar, nobody wanted to do it. So naturally, you would import a bunch of slaves and they would do all the work for you and they would all die. Like, you know, I forget what the mortality numbers are, but it's just tragic, horrible. And so over a very short time, in particular, the island of Barbados just became covered with sugar plantations and covered with slaves. So naturally, this led to a very harsh sort of slavery because there were so many slaves. They were worried about revolts, that sort of thing. But eventually, on Barbados especially, they ran out of land really quickly because those islands in the Caribbean are really tiny. So these second sons, these planters from Barbados would say, we've got all these second sons. They're not going to inherit any land. Let's send them all to South Carolina. And that's pretty much what happened. They sent a bunch of people to Carolina, and that was basically the dominant culture there, was this imported, super harsh slavery from Barbados. And that was imitated in South Carolina, and that kind of spread to the other colonies within America. In Virginia in the beginning, slavery had been rather, I don't want to say it was nicer, but it was, I mean, nicer relative to the Caribbean anyways. And there hadn't been, like, strict slave laws. They weren't really sure what the position of slaves in the in the Americas was going to be yet. And it was really the importation of the Caribbean idea of slavery that really took over America in the end. And that obviously had a big effect on American history in terms of this new tradition of slavery. And that was what wound up defining the South, as these planters from South Carolina wound up moving west into the Deep South, into Mississippi and Alabama and so on.
With issues of representation that come up later in America, like the three-fifths law, that a slave counts as three-fifths of a person in census data, and they wouldn't be counted in terms of the rights they would receive, of course. But do you know how in colonial America for slaves, how does this figure into things such as representation? Do you have a sense of that?
Well, how does it figure into the... Yeah, there was actually, slaves couldn't vote. They didn't own land.
Right.
Actually, there were slave elections in New England where they could vote for their own slave governors, basically. But that's kind of that's an unofficial non-governmental thing. There were actually no laws against blacks voting in most of the colonies in the 1600s. There were actually, I don't think there were any laws in New England against blacks voting up until, there may have never been laws against it. In South Carolina, actually, there are records of a few blacks voting. We know about that because there were records of people complaining to the legislature that blacks were voting. Blacks and Jews, these guys are voting. How can you let this happen? So we know that it happened at least sometimes. We know that it happened in Virginia a few times. It was very rare, though. There was such a big cultural gap between these two groups that any time people were voting was rare. But it was only in the, say, 1700s that with the introduction of harsher and harsher slave laws, harsher and harsher race laws that tended to separate them more clearly, that was when blacks were explicitly prohibited from voting. Whereas before, it had been kind of maybe frowned upon. Occasionally it happened. But in the beginning, nobody really knew what slavery was until like the 1700s. They didn't know how it would fit in with the whole legal system.
Right. You're moving from England that had exited the feudal system in the Middle Ages, which did not have slavery, to the New World, where all these new issues are being worked out. Something you mentioned earlier, that in the New England colonies, you said something about slaves voting on who their master would be. Did I understand that right?
No. No, there was a system. Well, let me take a step back. In West Africa, it was often common for kings to be elected rather than inheriting their position hereditarily. It didn't go to the first son or whatever. So that was a tradition that was actually kind of carried over in the New World and like the Caribbean and I think Brazil and New Orleans and in New England, where each year the slaves would get together and they would vote for a slave governor who would represent them for the year. Like, it was kind of an informal system of governing themselves. So, like, there was a system of informal courts among the slaves where if you had a complaint against if you were a slave and you had a complaint against another slave, you didn't want to go to the masters to deal with it. So you'd have your informal slave court system to deal with it. And at the top of this system was the slave governor, who was elected every year, in kind of a practice that was partly West African, partly New England inspired. And you would have this slave governor, or slave king, as they were known in different colonies. And he would basically act as a representative for the community for that year.
Well, thanks for mentioning that. That's actually a really good point, that if we just look at the official historical sources of elections, it's easy to bias everything to official government positions, which really limits the population that does vote. It's landholders, which are white males exclusively. But then yes, there's all these informal forms of representation among minority or marginalized communities. Like you said, among slave communities, they have their own representation, even though we can overlook it because it's not an official government. Have you seen other examples like this too, of non-majority or marginalized communities that have their own informal types of representation?
Not quite like that. I know that there was, for instance, I think the town of Stockbridge in Massachusetts was set up as sort of like an Indian reservation by some Christian missionaries or something. And they set up a government that was a town government that was in imitation of the town governments in New England, which was the standard form of government. So you had Indians who were qualified electors voting for people and that sort of thing. But I don't think that lasted very long. I think kind of the whites moved in through legal trickery and sort of forced out the Indians. So I can't think of any other examples that are quite as dramatic as slaves holding these big elections. They were actually quite big affairs. They would have their masters' horses. They would have their masters' swords. It was kind of shocking, really, how loose the masters were. But there weren't that many slaves in New England, so I guess they just weren't too worried about any sort of rebellion. But there's nothing quite that big elsewhere that I can think of off the top of my head.
Something else you focused on is events in Europe affecting the United States, with the 30 Years' War, the clashes between Catholics and Protestants in Europe, the English Civil War, Philip of Spain, I think. All these things that are happening in Europe in the 17th and 18th century, how are these events affecting the colonies?
It depends on the time period. In the earliest decades, it was barely at all. I mean, the colonies were really small, really isolated. Even during the English Civil War, that concerned the colonists in America, but it didn't really have a big impact except in Maryland, which had a revolt because they had their own problems. But for the most part, it was very calm for the first, up until the mid, late 1600s, I would say. There was very little impact. But then over time, as the colonies became more and more economically important, England focused a much bigger lens on the colonies as they realized how much money there was to be made, how much the colonies were coming under threat from the French, that sort of thing. So in the, say, 1670s, they started to realize, oh, we have this big mess in America. We've got all these little colonies. They don't cooperate with each other. They don't obey our orders. They're way too independent. So what we need to do is we need to challenge these colonies' right to exist, and we want to consolidate them into one big unit, or a few big units. So that's what they did. They started with Massachusetts because Massachusetts was like the most unruly of the colonies. It was big, it was Puritan, it was hostile to the English monarchy, basically. So they challenged the Charter of Massachusetts, which was basically their constitution. It was the right to exist as a legal, independent entity. And they kind of forced it through. I think in the end, the court case was decided against Massachusetts because Massachusetts just didn't send representatives to represent themselves in court. But then they lost their legal right to exist, and then they challenged all the other colonies in the North. And then they decided, we're going to consolidate all of these things into one big unit, which included all of New England, all of New York, all of New Jersey. So a big, huge mega colony called the Dominion of New England. And oh boy, did the colonists take that. They had been independent for, you know, like three generations in some places. They'd had their own court systems, they'd had their own legislatures, they had had their own everything, and that was all completely wiped away. But they didn't revolt at first, and that only came like 2 years later because of events in England. The monarch at the time who had been doing this consolidating was James II, and he was a Catholic. Now, as you were just talking about, the English hated the Catholics, and they hated having a Catholic king, but there wasn't much that seemed that they could do about it. But since he didn't have any Catholic heirs, it seemed like it would be a problem that would go away pretty quickly. But then he had a son, and this son would certainly be raised as a Catholic, which meant that his sons would be raised as Catholics, and his sons would be raised as Catholics, and so on. I mean, the godfather of this kid, the godfathers of this kid was literally Louis XIV and the Pope. So it's a very, very Catholic thing. And, oh boy, did the English hate that. And the king, James II's son-in-law, William of Orange, who was head of the Dutch Republic, took the chance to invade England, basically, and overthrew the monarchy. That's the Glorious Revolution. I mean, that's kind of a side issue from American history, but it had a big impact in the colonies in that that revolution inspired the colonists in New England to overthrow the Dominion of New England. Some mutinous soldiers marched down from the frontier in Maine into Boston. They raised a big militia, and within like a day, they'd overthrown the Dominion, imprisoned everyone who worked for the Dominion, and restored the old way of doing things. So in that way, it's very, very intimately tied up with English politics, in that English policies ended the old colonies, and then the invasion of England helped end those policies and bring back the old way of doing things. So that's one way they were tied together.
And about what time period is this?
Oh, sure. It's 1688, 1689, basically.
Right. Okay. Well, so here's something I'm curious about. This leaps a little bit ahead of where you are in the podcast. So, hey, spoiler alert. But about a century later, once we get into the early American Republic, it doesn't take long before elections start to get ugly. And for people who today complain that elections are ugly, I think, if you really think that, I'm sorry, my friend, but you don't know much about history. Like the 1796 John Adams versus Thomas Jefferson election, I love the lines used by some of the hatchet men against John Adams, saying that he is a hermaphrodite that has neither the firmness of a man or the softness of a woman, something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So what happens? How do we go from, in the early colonies, there isn't much of a population. Maybe you could buy a few boats with booze, but it's very informal. Up until the point where you have a media, you have a media industrial complex that has hatchet men that's using, trying to influence public perception. So how does this shift happen?
That's a good question. I actually have just been writing about this, not about the 1696 election, but about how partisan politics started to come into play in New England in the 1750s, 1760s about. And I think you have to step back and you have to try to put yourself in the mindset of what it was like before this. And today we think about voting as like a universal right that everyone has, that everybody has the right to influence their government. But it wasn't like that at all. The idea of voting back then was if your voting made the government work better, then you could vote. If not, not. So like women couldn't vote because they were dependent on their husbands. Landless people couldn't vote because they were dependent on their landlords, so they couldn't render independent judgment. So very different mindset, and no political parties as well, obviously. So the mindset was much more, who should we vote for? We should vote for the rich, upstanding guy, and we shouldn't really question his policies, and we should just, if he's not like completely messing up, we should just keep voting for him. So it was a very, very deferential, hierarchical culture, very, very different sort of elections than what we have today. And that begins to change, I think, basically as soon as you get incentives to do so, as soon as you get a big split within the colonies over some issue. And I think the media is part of it, but not the biggest part of it, I don't think, because, for instance, in Rhode Island in the 1750s, you have a split between two towns, Newport and Providence, and these are the two biggest towns in Rhode Island, and they're sort of fighting it out between each other over who's going to be the dominant town within Rhode Island, who's going to get the college, who's going to get all the trade, that sort of thing. And as soon as you have this tension, you have these two political parties essentially start to form, and they start doing electioneering, they start doing all sorts of things. They start printing newspapers against each other. But it's basically, as soon as you have this divide that splits things up, and as soon as the old culture, old deferential culture I was talking about, as soon as that's starting to wane, which it is in the 1700s, as soon as that happens, then the whole thing just collapses, basically. So I think you see that as well in the American Republic. The people who wrote the Constitution, the Founding Fathers, they were used to this old deferential way of doing things, just, and it was just about to collapse. And they weren't really aware of that the ground was shifting beneath them. And so they wrote a constitution which was designed for this old deferential way of doing things. But it turns out that it actually enabled partisan politics, all the stuff you were just talking about, all the nastiness, all the feuding. And so I think it's this change, is the old mindset sort of is disappearing. And as soon as you have an incentive to split a group of people into two parties, as soon as you have that, then split happens and you get modern politics, basically.
Can you describe how elections change in the 19th century? I'm not an expert on this period in American history. The little bit that I do know is that with the formation of political parties, that's where you get these political machines, especially after the Civil War. You have spoil systems. You have a lot of corruption before the 17th Amendment, when people can directly elect a senator. It's the state political parties that have a lot of power. So after this period when partisan politics form after the Revolution, what do elections look like from that point on?
I would say, like I said, the shift within Rhode Island, like I was just talking about, and there's a similar shift in Pennsylvania, something starting to happen in Connecticut and Massachusetts as well. What you get is something very modern very quickly. Like you get patronage, you get nastiness, you get all of these sorts of things. So I think that the shift takes a little while to happen. Like, it's not really until the age of Andrew Jackson that the entire shift happens. But really, you can see it within about 10 years in these individual cases. When it happens, it's very, very modern. So I think if you're imagining just like a more slightly more primitive version of modern politics, that's basically what it shifts to almost instantaneously, I would say, within these isolated instances, and then eventually in the country as a whole. But that's, takes about 50 years for it to completely play out.
What were some features of the presidential election with Andrew Jackson that you think brings these things about?
I'm not less of an expert in that, but I would just say it's partly that he was kind of a vulgar, low class kind of guy. I would mostly just say that it was just that the ground was shifting, that the old norms had completely eroded, that nobody cared about the old New England patriarchy anymore. Nobody cared about John Quincy Adams's family. I think it was more of the culmination of a long process that had largely been completed by then. That's just the point where you can say, yes, it's completely here. We're completely modern now. We're completely a populist democracy.
Right, where America is moving westward, it's moving over the Appalachians, and Jackson himself being sort of a product of this territory at the time and being in Tennessee. So there's not as much connection there to New England and those other places.
And there's a lot of economic fluidity on the frontier as well. So in New England, you had a bunch of established families. In Virginia, you had a bunch of established families who were always dominating politics for generation after generation. And you don't get that in the new colonies. You don't get that in the places that are growing fastest and so on. So I think that's probably another part of the reason why the old norms disappeared.
This period in the 19th century is really fascinating. To me, it sounds like the bit that I know, I'm astounded at how corrupt it seems to be, and how people at the height of politics, even people who would go on to become presidents, are right at the center of these political machines. So from your vantage point, what do you think are some of the most corrupt time periods for American elections?
Oh, man, I don't even know. Has there ever been a time when it wasn't corrupt? Like, it's a relative question. I imagine the machine politics here has got to be the most corrupt, but even in upstanding Puritan New England, you've got all sorts of nepotism. Like, I was just reading about Thomas Hutchinson, the last non-military governor of colonial Massachusetts, and like three of his kids were married to three of the kids of the lieutenant governors, and his brother-in-law was serving as like chief justice of the court there. And it's like, and he was appointing his kids to offices, and this was like an upstanding Puritan guy. I mean, he was hated for his corruption by the end because of other reasons, but like it was pretty standard. So yeah, I think politics, not just in America probably, but everywhere, has always been pretty corrupt. It's just a question of degrees, really. I would probably say the machine politics era, but I'm not sure.
Can you describe that a little bit? I know the overview, but just for the audience, what were political machines like? How did they work? And what did elections look like?
Oh, sure. Like I said, that's another period that I'm less of an expert on. But machine politics was basically how you would control big urban populations in like New York and Chicago. You'd have a group like was Tammany Hall in New York, and they would basically be political bosses. They would control patronage. They would control access to government jobs. You know, if you wanted to be a janitor, you had to be in with the right political party. You had to vote for them. You had to support them at the elections. So it was this whole apparatus of corruption, basically, to keep these guys in power, and they would keep you employed, and you know, it was sort of a you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. And a lot of it was to do with Irish immigrants, that sort of thing. Groups who were sort of outside the political mainstream, who maybe were just recent arrivals in America or something like that. And it gave them an access to power, basically. Like, they could participate in these party machines, they could get employed, they could have someone who was looking out for them, sort of. It was very corrupt, but that's probably about the only way you could have done urban politics back then. I don't know.
The title of your podcast, Early and Often, that applies very well to Kansas City, where I live. And we perfected machine corruption. We did it so well in the 1920s, and where Democratic candidates, part of the Democratic Tom Pendergast machine, would have over 100% of the vote. So we just excelled at it.
It's better than Stalin.
Well, another thing too, this is telescoping out a little bit, but it has to do with elections in the United States. It's a contemporary complaint against American electoral politics, and I wonder if this complaint applies across American history. And that is that the qualities that allow somebody to get elected do not make them an effective leader. And this has been applied, of course, by the left and the right for people who on the right who criticized Barack Obama, that he was an effective campaigner, but then he couldn't transmute that into effective electoral politics. And the argument's probably made much stronger against Donald Trump. So do you see this as being a complaint that has been made by people, or perhaps has been true across American history? Or is it more of a factor of the modern media age, where you have to have this media personality for broadcast media? So what do you think about that factor?
I'd say that people were concerned with demagogues from a very early point. Like in that earliest deferential phase of politics, which was from about, you know, the early 1600s to about 1750, say, there wasn't much concern about that because there weren't many populist politicians yet. But as soon as you do get those populist politicians, then you do get complaints like that, oh, this democracy isn't working. We're electing horrible people. We're electing corrupt people. Even like I said, in Rhode Island, the people who were leading both of these two parties, they both hated what they had become, basically. They're like, oh, no, we didn't want to create this two-party system, but we don't know how to get out of it. Now we're both at the head of these political parties, these machines. And, you know, oh, no, we're ruining government. You know, they even the guys at the time hated what the incentives of partisan politics were doing to them. So I think the specifics vary, but I think you get worries about demagogues and populists as soon as modern electoral politics begins, I would say.
And another thing to tie in a lot of these themes that we've been discussing, because you've looked into the history of American elections, what do you think that they can tell us about elections today, for presidential elections that people think is a blood sport, that many complain that they're ineffective, the electoral college doesn't work, other factors of American elections don't work. So what's your perspective on modern day elections based on what you've seen in history? What can history tell us?
There's an Adam Smith quote where he says, there's a great deal of ruin in a nation. And what he meant by that was nations can take an awful lot of damage before they collapse. Like, they can survive corruption, they can survive civil wars, they can survive all sorts of things. And I would say that if you look back in American political history, it's always been pretty terrible. I mean, in some level, but politics is always terrible. Like, there's always corruption and stupidity and, you know, nastiness and hate and all that sort of stuff. So when I look at the modern era, like, it's bad, but it's been worse. You know, I'm not even sure we're as bad as the 70s are, really. But there's always been just a litany of problems generation after generation. But that doesn't mean that America can't keep growing slowly, because, you know, throughout all that, there's bigger trends. There's technological development. There's people getting nicer, I would say, you know, at the end of slavery and all sorts of stuff. Really, society has become a lot kinder in a lot of ways. So if you look at the long-term trends, I think that can be more telling about where America or where any country is going, rather than just looking at the nastiness we see that's right before us. That's important, but it's always going to be there, and we can still grow. We can still overcome that.
All right. A note of optimism. I like that in the midst of a lot of pessimism. Well, yeah. David, thank you for sharing all this with us. If people want to find your podcast, where is the best place to find you online?
I'm on Twitter at earlyoftenpod, or my blog is at earlyoftenpodcast.wordpress.com, and I have transcripts of every episode if that's what people want instead of podcasts. So either of those two would be good.
Great, and I'll be sure to link to those in the show notes. David, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, that was a talk with David Severa on American elections. Again, his podcast is Early and Often, The History of Elections in America. All right, well, that was the episode for today. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you want to support the show and help me keep producing this content, there are four easy ways for you to do it. One, subscribe to the show and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you want to do that, you can go to historyunplugpodcast.com, and there you'll find instructions. Two, join our Facebook group, which you can find if you just search for History Unplugged. And please like and share posts that I put up about new episodes. This helps new people discover the show on social media. Three, submit a question to me so that I can answer it on air. You can email me at info@historyonthenet.com or leave a voicemail. And again, go to historyunplugpodcast.com and you'll find instructions. Lastly, check out the show on your Amazon Alexa. And to explain how to use it, here I'll refer to Alexa as Madam A, so I don't accidentally set it off for those of you listening at home. You can access it on any Madam A device. All you have to do is just say, Madam A, start History Unplugged, and you have complete access to the podcast. You can also try other commands like, Madam A, ask History Unplugged to play the latest episode, or Madam A, ask History Unplugged to search for World War II spies. And I'd really appreciate it if you'd rate and review History Unplugged on Amazon. And you can do this by going to historyonthenet.com/Alexa. Anyway, those are the ways you can help out the show. Thank you so much for your support. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.